From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A Hamas leader is silenced tonight, and Israel claims a victory over terrorism. But world reaction is loud and largely condemning. Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, co-founder and spiritual leader of the militant group with its long history of bombings, was killed by Israeli troops early this morning in a helicopter missile strike outside a Gaza City mosque. Today, 200,000 Palestinians took to the streets in the West Bank, Gaza, and southern Lebanon to mourn his death and vow revenge against Israel and the United States. In turn, Israel pledged the battle against Hamas will continue. Tonight on Point, death and consequences in Gaza for Israelis, for Palestinians, for Americans. We begin in Jerusalem with the latest developments. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. I asked him to describe reaction to today's events, beginning with the Palestinians.
It's been quite dramatic. Tens of thousands of people turned out in the streets in Gaza for the funeral. He was buried within a few hours of his assassination. And people in Gaza said it was the biggest demonstration of its kind since Arafat returned from exile to Gaza in 1994. And there's been a lot of relatively minor incidents, but individual incidents of violence, both in Gaza and the West Bank, where people have been demonstrating against the Israeli occupation. There are a couple of incidents in Jerusalem with people being attacked. Another man went berserk with an axe near Tel Aviv. And some people on board a bus in Jaffa, on the coast of Israel, were attacked by a man with a knife. So it's obviously inflamed a lot of emotions on the Palestinian side.
And perhaps more to come. What about general Israeli reaction, to the extent that you can describe that for us, Harvey?
Well, you know, it's strange. In a way, the Palestinian who the Israelis most love to hate is Yasser Arafat, because they feel that he somehow let them down by saying he wanted peace and then not doing a deal with them. At least that's the way they see it. Obviously, if Mr. Arafat had been removed in this way, it would have been politically a much more dramatic coup. But in a sense, the Israelis, I think, would have celebrated somewhat more. Sheikh Yassin, although he clearly wasn't liked by the Israelis, his death, I think, is seen as more of a threat of more violence to come. I mean, I think the Israelis are thinking this maybe wasn't such a brilliant idea because they do expect retaliation.
You had Hamas leaders today telling Palestinians not to cry but to be steadfast and be ready for revenge. And there's this colorful image of bringing death to every Israeli door. Does Hamas have the capacity to step up its attacks on Israel beyond the rather high rate that we've already seen?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be said that the nature of the rhetoric is fairly familiar to us here. They have said similar things in the past. It's pretty blood-curdling, and indeed, the bombings that sometimes have followed such threats have been fairly devastating. Hamas did surprise the Israelis somewhat earlier this month when they mounted an attack, apparently from the Gaza Strip, which is unusual, not so unique, when they hit the port of Ashdod, and 10 Israelis were killed in that attack. Obviously, their capacity has been somewhat damaged by the Israeli offensive against the leadership, and the incidence of suicide bombings is definitely lower than it has been at the height of the Palestinian uprising.
But death to every door almost suggests weapons of mass destruction. Do the Palestinians have access to such weapons?
I don't think so, and I think you can be misled by the rhetoric. As I say, they've said similar things in the past. I think the message they're trying to get across is that, you know, no one is safe from any bombing that they might mount. Also, it makes very clear that any suggestion, as there's been in the past, that attacks might be limited to the Palestinian territories or to soldiers and Jewish settlers within the occupied territories is now definitely off, and they will carry on with attacks inside Israel.
Harvey, Ahmed Kori, the Palestinian prime minister, today said that this was crazy and very dangerous. He said it opened wide the door to chaos. He said Sheikh Yassin is known for his moderation. How do you interpret all that?
Well, moderation is a strange word, I must admit, to apply to a leader of an organization such as Hamas. But one sort of understands what he means. I mean, some Israelis who watch Hamas very closely say that Sheikh Yassin was at least a pragmatist. I mean, his main aim in his political career was to establish a really central role for the Islamic movement in guiding the political development of Palestine. I mean, he was after creation of a Palestinian state which would be Islamic and not just independent. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't sort of born to go out and bomb Israelis. That was something that almost came later in his political career. The fear is now that with him out of the way, and also with the founding generation of Hamas leaders on the run, I mean, he's not the first one of the founders to be assassinated, that rather more young and less experienced and even more hot-headed people might take control. And what is has come to be called the controlled violence of Hamas under Yassin may give way to something more chaotic.
And finally, Harvey, what about on the Israeli government side and Prime Minister Ariel Sharon there? With this assassination completed, his government is now poised for what in Israel's relationship with the Palestinians?
Well, as far as we understand it, he's still on course for his unilateral withdrawal from Gaza. The Foreign Minister, Sylvain Shalom, has been in Washington discussing it on the very day of the assassination. So I think part of his motivation in carrying out this attack against Yassin now is perhaps to persuade his critics on the right wing that if he does pull out, he's not going to be doing so as a retreat from terrorism, but that he's going to try and destroy the militants before the Israelis actually leave.
Harvey Morris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. What was your immediate gut-level reaction to Sheikh Ahmed Yassin's killing? Is this a bloody step toward peace or toward more conflict? And how have America's interests been affected today, for better or for worse? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Meir Shlomo. He has more than 20 years of diplomatic experience with the Foreign Ministry of Israel under his belt. In 1991, he served as a member of Israel's delegation to the peace talks in Washington and is now serving as Consul General of Israel to New England. Good evening and welcome, Meir Shlomo.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. And with us tonight from Atlanta, Georgia, is Michael Tarazi, legal advisor for the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO. Good evening and welcome, Michael Tarazi.
Good evening.
Meir Shlomo, to you first. Where do you see the killing early this morning fitting into Israel's overall plan for dealing with the Palestinians?
Well, first of all, let me say quickly, Israel does not celebrate the death of Sheikh Yassin. We do not celebrate death even when it has to do with our most devoted enemies. But let's first call a spade a spade. Sheikh Yassin was no Mother Teresa. Sheikh Yassin is the very man that led the organization that is in charge and responsible to the killing, most the vicious killing of Israelis during the last 15 years. He is actually the most prominent practitioner of terror in the Middle East, and he unfortunately inspired nothing but hatred towards Israelis and towards Jews. He and his organization tried again and again to derail any peace process and any compromise between Israelis and Palestinians. And we should remember that even during the Oslo process, the honeymoon that we had with the Palestinians, Hamas kept attacking Israelis, kept killing Israelis, actually killed 255 Israelis. And it was not only about attacking Israelis. It was a direct attack on the peace process itself. And unfortunately, they succeeded to a certain extent.
So there have been many Israeli deaths. We've all seen it, the bus bombings and all the rest. And there's been a long-standing call for the death of Sheikh Yassin. This is not the first attempt to kill the Sheikh. Nevertheless, the same question, how does it fit into a larger picture? Is this just knocking down one leader, or what's the strategic envelope around this?
Well, I think we have two legs to this strategic envelope. One leg is dealing with terror, and the other leg is about trying to seek any kind of political settlement with the Palestinians. As far as the terror goes, obviously, Hamas is a vicious terrorist organization, an organization that is against any compromise between Israelis and Palestinians, and as such threatens both Israelis and Palestinians. So I think a weaker Hamas is good news to everybody who is looking forward to peace in this region. As far as the other leg, Israel will keep seeking leadership within the Palestinian that will agree to have a Palestinian state alongside the State of Israel and not instead of the State of Israel. And the disengagement plan of Prime Minister Sharon is only the recent step that we have offered in this direction.
Michael Tarazi in Atlanta, your response to the killing of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin this morning.
Well, I think it's very clear that as part of the Sharon strategy to continue the cycle of violence we've experienced for the last 3 years. Nobody should be surprised by that. Sharon was only electable in a period of violence, and he needs to make sure that that violence continues in order to remain in power. This is part of the strategy that I believe the Israeli representative is not being particularly honest about. Sharon knows perfectly well what the response will be, and that's exactly the response that he wants. That will allow Sharon then to continue carrying out his very harsh and repressive measures against the Palestinian people under occupation, and it will divert attention and pressure from Sharon to actually sit down at the negotiation table and to actually recognize that he, as an occupying power, is subject to international laws that he has violated throughout his entire history.
Well, Michael Tarazi, are you saying then implicitly that if Israel no longer pushed on the Palestinians, Palestinians would mount no violence? There's been no shortage of apparent willingness to commit violent actions from the side of the Palestinians.
We have to remember, Israel's lack of security is directly linked to the Palestinian lack of freedom. So if Israel's really concerned about its security, it would take steps that would actually allow the Palestinians to live in the same freedom and security that Israel demands for itself. Instead, it takes actions that continue to inflame the situation, such as the assassination this morning. But what I'm trying to get to your listeners is that this is not a surprise to Sharon. Sharon knows perfectly well that this will result in more violence, but that's part of his strategy.
Council Shlomo said here that this will result in a weaker Hamas. Do you agree, Michael Tarazi?
I would tend to agree more with Harvey Morris from the Financial Times, who said that this will probably produce a much more chaotic and inexperienced Hamas and a much more chaotic form of violence than we've experienced in the past. But again, this is also part of what Sharon is expecting and what he wants. Because without this violence, Sharon cannot continue his policies. He cannot continue, for example, building the wall inside occupied Palestinian territory rather than building it on Israel's border. This is the kind of camouflage he needs in order to confiscate more land and in order to continue the suffering of the Palestinian people and the occupation.
Mayor Shlomo, the European Union today condemned the killing, called it extrajudicial killing, said it's likely to further inflame violence. You heard in the news at the top of the hour, Scott McClellan, the White House spokesman, ambiguous at best in his response. How do you interpret this? If the case for the killing is so clear, why this condemning world reaction, even the United States' kind of very lukewarm reaction?
Well, I think you can attribute that to the fact that we have a saying in Hebrew that what you see from afar, you don't see from other places. And I think the European Union is a very good case in point. They tend to try to deflect events and disregard events if it does not have to do directly or influence directly Europe. As for the American reaction, I heard it very clearly that they say, the White House spokesperson saying that Israel has the right to defend itself, and that, in his words, Hamas is an atrocious terrorist organization. And
all true, but also said that they were deeply troubled by the killing, an odd juxtaposition.
Well, I'd like to surprise you. We are also deeply troubled by the fact that we had to take this measure, and we would not have taken this measure if the Palestinian Authority would have lived to its perfectly most basic obligation, that is to fight terrorism within the Palestinian society, and take charge of the Palestinian area that is under its responsibility.
Well, maybe deeply troubled, but Yassin was described today by a top Israeli official as Israel's bin Laden. In killing that person, there's a kind of, you object to the word celebration, I understand, but nevertheless, a kind of satisfaction that a long-term target has been hit.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look at bin Laden, who was enjoying the sponsorship of Taliban, and this is the reason why Taliban is not with us anymore, and bin Laden is chased all over Pakistan. I would suggest very much that either the Palestinian Authority will do what it has to do, or we will have to chase the terrorists. We have no other alternative.
Mayor Shlomo, Michael Tarazi, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the high-stakes killing in Gaza and its consequences. What was your immediate gut-level reaction to the news of Sheikh Yassin's killing? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the high-stakes killing in Gaza today and its consequences, about what's next for Israel and the Palestinians, for war and peace. You can join the conversation tonight. Is this a bloody step toward peace or toward more conflict? Why has this day brought such global condemnation of the killing? Why? And what should Palestinians make of Yassin's death? What should Israelis make of Sharon ordering the killing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. World leaders and power players are weighing in on the killing today. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak called it cowardly. There were also strong words from Britain's Foreign Secretary Jack Straw about Israel's actions.
It is not entitled to go in for this kind of unlawful killing, and we therefore condemn it. It is unacceptable. It is unjustified, and it is very unlikely to achieve its objectives.
Speaking today on NBC's Today Show, U.S. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said the U.S. does not condone the attack, but said Israel had its reasons.
Let's remember that Hamas is a terrorist organization, and that Sheikh Yassin has himself personally, we believe, been involved in terrorist planning. But, of course, the United States did not have advance warning.
I'm joined tonight in the studio by Meir Shlomo. He's Consul General of Israel to New England. From Atlanta, Georgia, by Michael Tarazi, legal advisor to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And now also with me in the studio, Naomi Kazan served in the Knesset from 1992 to 2003 as a member of the Meretz Party. She's former deputy speaker of the Israeli Knesset. She's a professor of political science at Hebrew University, now a fellow at MIT. Good evening and welcome, Naomi Kazan.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us tonight. Help us sort this out. We go through this cycle of events this way and that way, and it's hard to know exactly what to make of it. How do you understand? How do you see this killing this morning? Is this a positive step toward some kind of resolution, as Meir Shlomo is saying? Is it, as Michael Tarazi is saying, just another crank of the wheel of violence?
I'm afraid that I think it's part of a cycle of violence. I think it is another blow to moderates. I know it's a blow to Israeli moderates. I think it's a blow to Palestinian moderates as well, because it forces them to express solidarity with the Hamas and indirect, at least in public opinion in Palestine, to express support also for the continuation of violence. And we heard this a few minutes ago from Michael Tarazi. In other words, there's a cycle of violence. It serves no real purpose. It has nothing to offer. The status quo is a non-starter at the moment. And continuing this cycle is really a reflection of two things. Number one, that the extremists on both sides are setting the agenda. And number two, and perhaps more important, you need courage today, both Israeli, moderate Israelis and moderate Palestinians, to break the cycle and to break the blame game. In other words, I think it was a mistake. Whether it's justified or not is not the issue. It was simply not a smart move. It does not promote Israeli security, and it does not advance the Palestinians in their just quest for a Palestinian state alongside Israel.
Meir Shlomo, Naomi Kazan's been in the Knesset for a long time. Not now. You're in the government and so have to speak for the government. How do you respond to this perspective?
Well, first of all, I'm proud to be with Naomi Kazan in the same studio. I think this is a great example of what Israel is all about. It's about pluralism. It's about different opinions. And it's not only a joke that every two Israelis have three opinions. So I'm really proud that we can actually demonstrate this diversity. To some extent, I also agree with her. I mean, at the short term, of course, it will sort of produce more violence, especially on the part of the retaliation that Hamas has, quote-unquote, promised us. The question is, though, for the long term. And I would say it's somewhat like treating cancer in a body to some extent, that you would like to, I mean, if you give a chemotherapy, surely it's not a nice experience biologically to somebody who goes through this treatment. However, when you have to treat such an issue, you have to do something that might be violent a little bit. But if you have no other alternative, then you should face the consequences and go ahead with that.
But I hear, Naomi Kazan, I thought I heard you speaking to the long term, saying that there's a cycle that for the sake of the long term must be broken.
Precisely. Look, I think it's fairly certain at the moment that there will be immediate retaliation. There's been talk of it in the past 12 hours, it's bound to happen. And that in itself is sufficient reason not to engage in an act which you know ahead of time is going to bring immediate violence on Israelis. And undoubtedly, again, unfortunately, it's going to bring more terrorist attacks. But my point was precisely the long-term strategic point. The best scenario is that the violence will continue at a level that we know. But the worst scenario is something much more dangerous, indeed. And that scenario is that the Hamas, which has been very, very careful not to engage in violence outside the boundaries of the State of Israel, will expand that to Jewish targets elsewhere outside of Israel, or perhaps to American targets, in which case it simply fuels what is already a fire and makes it into a flame that it will be very difficult to control. In other words, this, in all probability, is an ill-advised move. It does not get us to where we belong, which is the negotiating table.
Michael Tarazi, in Atlanta, as you listen to this conversation between two Israelis, as an advisor for the PLO, do you see in this range of opinion expressed here an opportunity to engage with Israel or not?
Well, I find it interesting because even when I talk to Israelis, when I am in Israel, I'm surprised to see how much they talk about violence, but they never talk about the cause of the violence. I haven't really heard either the Israeli consul or Naomi speak about the occupation, which is, of course, the root cause of the violence. You cannot deny a people freedom for nearly 37 years, take their homes, demolish their homes, confiscate their property, cage them in by building walls around them, and then expect to have peace. So if they are truly serious about how to move the peace process forward, they have to stop talking about the symptom of violence and rather talk about the underlying disease of occupation, oppression, and the denial of rights and freedoms to Palestinians simply because they are Christians and Muslims and what Israelis want to have is a Jewish state. We have to talk about that discrimination, and I don't hear Israelis talking about that very often, and therefore it's not surprising that they don't adopt policies that actually address the issues, and this is why, after 3 years, we are actually making matters worse, not better.
Michael, we'll turn and look at occupation, but what about the goals of some Palestinians? And we've heard these goals voiced today in anger in response to the killing of Sheikh Yassin, the goal of getting Israelis out of Israel, even getting rid of Israel entirely.
Well, don't forget, if Palestinians have actually recognized Israel's right to exist on 78% of historic Palestine, we have never heard of any Israeli government recognizing Palestine's right to exist on the occupied portion, the remaining 22%. So if we're talking about who is denying the rights to whom, we have to understand that Palestinians have recognized Israel. We have not had an Israeli government ever recognize Palestine's right to exist. Yes, today's assassination will definitely polarize the population. You will only feed further extremism, and we see that in various statements today, as you just mentioned. But that's, of course, part of the Israeli strategy, or at least I should say part of Sharon's strategy. Polarize the population so that he can have the Israeli population itself polarized so that he can then carry out even further repression and continue the cycle.
Mayor Shlomo, we're hearing from your fellow Israeli, Naomi Kazan, and from Michael Tarazi, both pushing back against this picture of the long-term well-being, and Michael Tarazi asking for some acknowledgement of occupation. How do you respond?
Well, I suggest that Michael Tarazi, when he is in Israel, will listen a bit more carefully. I mean, Prime Minister Sharon spoke in his very own party about the need that we do not want to occupy the Palestinian people, and about recognition of the right of Palestinians to a Palestinian state. However, that said, what I'm really missing in Michael Tarazi's comments is that maybe he should tell all the audience and all our listeners, what does Hamas stand for? Hamas is not about 67. It's not about the occupation, like Michael Tarazi claims. Hamas is about throwing Israel out of the map altogether. They are very clear about it. It's not something that they say when they are angry. It's a policy of the Hamas. They want all Israel out altogether. The very existence of Israel for them is an irritant. And it's really, I can only be sorry for the fact that instead of Michael Tarazi, instead of trying to defend the Hamas, should really try to look for other avenues to get some kind of a dialogue with Israel rather than defending Hamas.
Michael Tarazi, is there some point of resistance to the existence of Israel that Palestinians could somehow erase to put both sides at ease here?
I'm not sure I quite understood the question.
Well, you understand, Council Shlomo is saying Hamas wants to throw Israel out, and this is repeatedly cited as a reason that Israel cannot, should not trust Palestinian counterparts in negotiation or much of anything else sometimes.
I think that's absurd, and I think the consul knows perfectly well that there are parties in the Israeli cabinet that advocate transfer of the Palestinian population, and yet certainly he's not saying that Palestinians would be justified in assassinating them. So I don't believe that the consul is dealing particularly honestly with the audience. With respect to the one comment he made with respect to Sharon, announcing that, yes, even Sharon wants to end the occupation over the Palestinian people, I think we have to listen very carefully, i.e., he didn't say end the occupation over Palestinian territory. He said end the occupation over Palestinian people, meaning somehow carve away some sort of reservation, some sort of vassal state on a fraction of Palestinian territory, put all the Palestinians there and call that a state. And so this is exactly the kind of detailed, nuancing, doublespeak that Israelis engage in to the Americans, but yet back at home, the Palestinians get understand the reality of what Israel really means by their statements. And so unless Israelis are perfectly willing to look in the mirror and say, we don't have security today because the Palestinians don't have their freedom, then I don't have much hope that this is really going to get resolved anytime soon.
I want to turn to our callers. Ted is calling from Boston. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hey there. How are you?
Fine, thanks, Ted.
Great to be part of this discussion. I certainly agree wholeheartedly with your, mostly with your female guest,
Naomi Kazan, the former Knesset member, with us in the studio.
Yeah. The issue that I wanted to make is that I think that there is most anyone who is looking at this with a sense of reality and not taking one side exclusively over the other, we see that there clearly is a cycle of violence. What disturbs me is that the Israelis seem to have a number of tools in their belt, so to speak, to try and get through to reach some kind of resolution. And the Arabs, the Palestinians, seem to only have violence. There doesn't seem to be another strategy that they can employ. And I don't know, therefore, what kind of options they leave for the Israeli government. I don't condone everything that the Israeli government has done, but I also don't see a realistic strategy that they can take to provide safety and security.
Ted, stand by. Michael Tarazi, do you want to speak directly to this caller, Ted?
Absolutely. I think he raises a very good point, that what are some alternative strategies the Israelis could deal with? Well, I would say one strategy is to actually recognize that as an occupying power, they have to abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention, and that they have to recognize and respect the rights of the occupied population. For example, Israel could stop building settlements. They can move settlers out into Israel rather than incentivizing to move into occupied Palestinian territory. They could start allowing greater freedom of movement for the Palestinians. They could allow them to build their homes. They can allow them to travel freely and engage in free business and to allow them to travel outside the country freely. Those are a lot of steps that the Israelis could take to prove to Palestinians that their strategy is not to continue occupying them, but actually to end the occupation.
But Ted, if I may, Michael, Ted, is that what you're looking for?
Well, I hear that, but I think there, and I certainly agree that there are some provocative measures, where the wall is being built and so forth. But many of the things that I think that your guest is talking about are not really realistic in the when you're talking about being in the context of, bombs going off in despite security measures, bombs going off strictly civilian places. I don't see that how one can say that they should have, that they should give them more freedom of movement and so forth, when that's just going to lead to more of these terrorist attacks, more of these on civilians, not even on military.
Ted, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Michael Tarazi, yes?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify. When I talk about freedom of movement, I don't mean about freedom of movement into Israel. I mean freedom of movement within occupied Palestinian territory. I mean, no one's asking for the right to move into Israel or to travel into Israel. That's an international border. We just want the right to be able to travel around in our own country. So I don't see how we can argue that would create greater violence.
Michael Tarazi, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Fairfax City, Virginia, Melissa Maley. She's a former CIA field officer who worked in the occupied territories from 1996 to 2001. She's currently a security and foreign policy consultant. Good evening and welcome, Melissa Maley.
Hello. It's nice to join you tonight.
Thanks for joining us. Your response to the killing today and where it takes this whole relationship?
Well, in many ways, I feel like the ground has shifted a bit rather significantly. The impact of the killing of Sheikh Yassin is still being assessed, but I think that ultimately the calculations that are being made or have been made is, does killing him change the power structure in Gaza and within the Palestinian areas, and does that make peace more or less likely? I believe that the Israelis, their calculation was, yes, that's going to take them down a path that they want to go, whereas I think that other people are saying, no, this is just taking us right back to a cycle of violence that's going to be as very vicious and something like we haven't seen since the 1995-1996 bus bombing campaign.
Naomi Kazan, what path do you think the government of Israel is trying to get onto here?
I'm not sure I can understand it entirely. I would like to believe that it is towards some kind of understanding, but I think perhaps Mr. Schoen is trying to set the groundwork, lay the groundwork for accepting a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, although this move may create a real power vacuum in Gaza, so it's not very clear. I find myself curiously right in the middle of this discussion between the Consul General and Michael Tarazi, because I have been fighting for the past 30 years for the creation of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, along the 1967 boundaries. I think Michael knows that very well, because I see it in Israel's uppermost interest. But I cannot condone for a moment an attempt to justify violence of the kind that we have witnessed in the past 3.5 years, because that in itself does not promote the goal of the end of the occupation and a real peace agreement.
And are you talking Palestinian violence, Israeli violence?
Exactly. And
both.
Therefore, I'm really concerned at this point that there is a cycle. It can be broken. But it requires a great deal of sanity from people who understand that there is no military solution to the conflict. Israel cannot defeat terrorism by the use of force. I think it's high time that we understood that. And the Palestinians cannot defeat the Israeli occupation by the use of force. And once one understands that, one has to go right back where we belong, which is the negotiating table.
We're talking tonight with Naomi Kazan, Michael Tarazi, Consul General Meir Shlomo, and Melissa Maley joining us from Virginia. You can join us as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Does the death of the top spiritual leader of Hamas make it safer for Ariel Sharon to pull out of Gaza? We're not. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the high-stakes killing in Gaza today of Hamas leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and the consequences of that killing. Joining me tonight in the studio, Consul General of Israel to New England, Meir Shlomo, also former Deputy Speaker of the Israeli Knesset, Naomi Kazan. From Atlanta, Georgia, we're joined by Michael Tarazi, an advisor to the PLO, and from Fairfax City, Virginia, by Melissa Maley. She worked with the CIA in the occupied territories for 5 years until 2001. Daniel is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing tonight?
Great, thanks. Great.
I'm an Israeli citizen, and I wanted to point out today that I've been listening to a lot of people talk on the Israeli and Palestinian sides, and I feel like constantly that people are just pointing fingers at the other, that they're blaming the other for their responsibility and using facts to say that, well, you pushed first, you bombed us first, and you retaliated first. And it's interesting that adults, grown men and women who have gone, hopefully, through a lot of life experiences, still point fingers and are not willing to look at themselves and take responsibility for their own actions.
Daniel, how could some self-reflection, if that's the case, how could some greater self-reflection be encouraged here?
I think it takes a process of being willing to trust themselves, just individuals, and go through this process. There's a lot of organizations that are doing this type of work in Israel and in Palestine. Unfortunately, there's so much baggage that people carry. The Israelis carry baggage of being beaten on for so long that they have become the abusers and can't even see that that's such a typical process. And the Palestinians have been, you know, beaten on for so long, and they feel abused constantly, and that's their role, is we are the abused, and so therefore they don't have to take responsibility. Or the same thing with the Israelis.
Daniel, let us pick it up. Melissa Maley, our time is short, but what's your suggestion here? We saw dramatic action today. We're hearing a range of opinions on its utility tonight. Daniel says, hey, let's everybody be more forthcoming and snap out of this somehow. How do you do that, though?
Well, you know, everybody's been saying that for 3 years, and we seem to have stayed with the same strategy of violence and more violence, because ultimately both sides have yet to come to the conclusion that violence, that through violence, that they can win. And both strategies are win strategies, and there has yet to be a negotiation strategy to work through this. And as well, you know, the two sides are continuing the same mode, there's no way to break out of the cycle.
Michael Tarazi, do you see a true, honest negotiation strategy, some path to that here or not?
Well, it's difficult, because as I hear the conversation, I'm disturbed by the sort of false symmetry between the two parties, as if these are Palestinians and Israelis, and they both just need to grow up and sit down and talk and, you know, and be mature about things. This is not a conflict between two equal parties. This is a conflict between an occupier and an occupied, a very strong power over a very weak power. And so, therefore, negotiations really can't work when you have this very strong party and a very weak party. And I'm kind of disturbed by the idea of constant calls for negotiations. I mean, no one said when Kuwait was occupied by Iraq that the Kuwaitis should just sit down and negotiate with the Iraqis. We said, no, occupation is wrong. Iraq, get out of Kuwait, and we're going to force you to do it if you don't. Why then do we look at the Palestinians and say, you have to negotiate for your rights? We're not going to enforce your rights.
Mayor Shlomo, occupier and occupied, do you accept this framing?
Well, you know, I can only regret that Michael Tarazi keeps hanging to this occupy-occupied business. That's not the real question. The real question is whether the Palestinians have it within them to really decide that violence is not the way and compromise is the way. We went to Camp David 2000, offered them practically everything they were asking for, and the only answer we got to this extended head for peace was just the Intifada. I think that it's high time that the Palestinians will really come back to the negotiating table and try to find, together with us, a negotiated agreement.
Naomi Kazan, finally to you. Washington's role in all this, what can, what should, what ought it be?
Well, I'll say it in one very short sentence, if I may, because it goes back to negotiating strategies. The roadmap has been called dead, declared dead.
The roadmap.
The roadmap. It is a U.S.-led roadmap. I don't think it's dead. I think it's been abandoned by the United States. I think the United States has a role to play. It has a responsibility, as does the entire world, and that is to bring the sides together to the negotiating table. And therefore, I think the time has come that the United States not abandon the roadmap, but revive it even in election year.
Tough to do, but there's the advice from former Deputy Speaker of the Israeli Knesset, Naomi Kazan. Thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Mayor Shlomo, Consul General of Israel to New England, thank you very much for joining us. Michael Tarazi, Legal Advisor to the PLO, joining us from Atlanta. Thanks very much for being with us tonight. And Melissa Maley, former CIA field officer in the occupied territories from 1996 to 2001. Thank you for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, former U.S. Chief Weapons Inspector David Kaye. This is On Point. The controversy over the lead-up to the war in Iraq is growing, and with the presidential election looming on the horizon, both sides are poised to make political hay out of statements made by anyone involved. Former administration counterterrorism chief Richard Clark's new book is the most recent and maybe hardest-hitting example. 6 weeks ago, it was former United States Chief Weapons Inspector David Kay in the spotlight with his conclusion that the U.S. was, quote, all wrong in its insistence that Iraq was hiding weapons of mass destruction. Earlier today, I asked David Kay how his testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee has been used by others in the weeks since he spoke out.
Well, I guess the surprising thing, although it really shouldn't have been surprising if I'd thought about it, is the term you applied to it used is exactly what strikes me the most. I've often said I felt like I was going to a Super Bowl TV party to watch the game, and everyone else, there were advertising specialists, and they wanted to watch the ads. People clearly had their own agendas, and they parsed the testimony and statements to support whatever argument they wanted to make. You know, that's the nature of the gotcha politics that we now live in.
Well, let's look at a couple of more specific instances then. The president has referred in some very high-profile settings to your reference to weapons of mass destruction-related programs as a kind of justification ex post facto for the war. Does that sit well with you?
Well, I mean, I think it is accurate that we did find a number of weapons-related programs that were ongoing. Certainly the missile one was the largest one. Is that the same as large stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction? No, it's not. It's in no sense the equivalent of that. So I think it's an accurate statement with regard to what we did find, but it is not a substitute justification for going to war.
And what about, you've been very widely quoted and repeatedly saying, it turns out we were all wrong. That has been used very vigorously by critics of the war. What do you make of that usage?
Well, I think that's fair. In fact, I must say the most striking thing to me in terms of what we found is that almost all analysts, both inside and outside the government, who looked at Iraq's WMD program over about 12 years turned out to have been wrong about what existed probably for the last 6 years or so of that program.
What about then on the front of U.S. intelligence? George Tenet has been speaking out quite a lot also in these last 6 weeks. Do you get the feeling that the problems you were pointing to in U.S. intelligence gathering and interpretation are being addressed?
No, I think they are not being addressed. In fact, that the most disturbing thing to me over the last 6 weeks is that the government as a whole, and I include the president and George Tenet, rather than simply admit we were wrong, almost all of us, in fact, were wrong about what Iraq's program looked like, and expressing a determination to find out why and to fix it. Instead, the dominant reaction from the administration has been to duck that issue and to, and certainly it's true of Director Tenet, not to admit that we were wrong and not to commit to a fundamental reexamination of U.S. intelligence, which I find is absolutely essential.
What's the evidence to you that George Tenet and the Bush administration are ducking that challenge?
Well, the evidence is, first of all, a failure to admit and, as you initially said, to try to slide the language into a weapons-related program and not to admit that the fact that no weapons of mass destruction have been found is a fundamental error. I don't see a commitment to root and branch, look at the intelligence that we had before the war and find out why we got it so wrong.
There are any number of gentlemen in the public eye right now, since you came out, David Kay, with their own take on the Bush administration in the run-up to 9/11, in the run-up to war. Hans Blix, Richard Clark just yesterday, Paul O'Neill earlier. With your experience of having brought your story to the fore, what do you make of the cycle of news and interpretation that you and all of these men have gone through, are going through, and the way it gets processed by the country?
Well, there certainly is great interest, at least without I've talked to Dr. Blix briefly, and I'm to see him this next week. But if his experience is anything like mine, I'm sure Richard Clark's is very similar, you're going to say there, you come away with a deep, abiding interest of not only the American public, it's really a worldwide media interest in this. I think that's healthy in terms of entering the public debate and looking at fundamental issues. What makes me uncomfortable is when it degenerates into very personal examination. It becomes the fundamental issues of whether we've done enough with regard to terrorism, or we did enough with regard to Iraq intelligence, or we abandoned inspections too early. All of those are really momentous public issues that need to be discussed quite free of personalities. We tend to take it back to personalities again. I think that's It's part of the time we live in. The reality show era of television has degenerated. Public debate has tended to degenerate in much the same way.
Is it the Bush administration that has helped take it back to personalities? They were very hard on Paul O'Neill. They were tough at Hans Blix. At a number of points, Condoleezza Rice just in the last 24 hours has been pretty tough on Richard Clark. You may have taken some hits as well. Is that a strategy of self-defense on the part of this administration?
No, I think the administration has adopted a reply, let no slight go unrewarded with an attack. But I really don't blame them for that. I think in many ways we're going back over at least two, three presidential election cycles. A significant portion of the American people did not accept the legitimacy of the election of President Bush. And I think earlier there was a significant, probably not as large a segment of the American public, which didn't accept Bill Clinton's presidential election. We've entered a really, truly nasty period of American politics. I thought John McCain got it really right last week when he said, in trying to defend Senator Kerry against attacks, that he was weak on national security, which strikes me as a preposterous assertion on its face, and that tells you something about the era we've ended in. Senator McCain said, you know, we're going to have one of the dirtiest, if not the dirtiest, election cycles in terms of personal attacks that he can imagine.
David Kaye, were you ever put under pressure to mute your critique of the absence of weapons of mass destruction, the intelligence surrounding that absence?
Depends on what you mean by pressure. Was I challenged in my interpretation? Yes, and I view that as not pressure. I think that's absolutely the proper thing to do. I think views deserve to be challenged. We get better policy like that. Were there some people who clearly said they hoped I wouldn't publicly express those views? Yes, but I took that not as pressure, just as, you know, hopes of policymakers who were going to be extremely discomforted by what I was about to do.
And finally, your conclusion. Were the missing WMD because of plain, simple, bad intelligence, primarily, or a bad use of intelligence, or a deliberate spin on poor intelligence?
You know, that's the most important question to be asked. And for me, my answer to that is it was fundamentally bad intelligence, because I'll tell you why I believe that. There were, if you go back and look at the Clinton administration, certainly Secretary Cohen, Secretary Albright's comments on Iraq's WMD, they were as strident as anything in the Bush administration. And the fact is, there were a large number of analysts outside the government who drew more or less the same conclusion. So I think the root cause was, in fact, intelligence. Now, that's not to say that policymakers didn't choose the best parts of intelligence to support their arguments. That's usually the case. There's nothing remarkable about that, and I think that occurred in this case. I think it is important to examine, though, whether they stepped across the line and chose to ignore certain warnings in the intelligence without telling the public they were stepping across that line and making a judgment quite distinct from that of the intelligence community. I must say, from the intelligence I saw, and I came into this after the war, I did not see any crossing of that line, but I think that is an appropriate thing to examine.
David Kaye, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
David Kaye is the former Chief U.S. Weapons Inspector in Iraq. We spoke earlier today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.